So the latter 1940s witnessed a return of prosperity to the town and to its paper mill. Things were looking pretty good. Things were looking pretty bright. But that was about to change. By the 1940s, the Mississippi River, long dammed and harnessed, had come to be taken quite for granted in Grand Rapids. No longer did the river serve as the focal point of the community as it had in its early days, or seem its very reason for existence. The Mississippi was still a source of water power for the paper company, but it had lost its all-important role as the steam power plant provided an increasingly large share of the needed electricity in the mill. However, as a source of the vast amounts of water required for papermaking, the river remained vital to the paper company. Sometimes, during periods of low water, virtually all the flowage of the river was diverted through the mill. Nonetheless, tamed and seemingly comfortably under control, the river was, even in the paper mill, not the center of attention and concern as had formerly been the case. But the Mississippi, serenely flowing over the once formidable rapids, was about to deliver a strong reminder that Grand Rapids was and remained a river town. The heart of the dam, built in 1901 at the foot of the Grand Rapids of the Mississippi River, consisted of stout timber cribs filled with stone. Over the years, especially in 1917 and again in 1930, various alterations and additions had been made, and new power-generating equipment had been installed. What was referred to in Grand Rapids in the 1930s as the rebuilt permanent dam consisted of some new concrete work and a cap and walkway placed on top of the existing structure. It looked new and durable and imposing, but the wooden rock-filled cribs erected by the men and horses brought from Kokana in 1901 were still the core of the dam structure. During the summer of 1948, professional divers checked the dam for reported leaks, and repairs were soon begun. But the dam structure that had withstood almost five decades of pressure and occasional battering was being undermined, ironically, all the faster because of the techniques of those doing the work. A crew of eight men worked on the dam foundation as the summer drew to a close. Friday, September 3rd, 1948, was a pleasant, clear day. The temperature reached 88 degrees just before 2 p.m., when one of the workmen noticed an evil-looking whirlpool in the reservoir waters adjacent to the dam just below the grinder room. He called a warning, and the men deserted their work to head for the shoreline. Everything moved with destructive speed. Suddenly, a lamppost mounted on the dam trembled violently. Muddy water appeared in the machine pits of the hydraulic pocket grinders. As the water rose to spread over the floor, the men hurriedly splashed their way out. Power engineer George Gels was in his office when he heard shouts of impending disaster. He rushed to turn off the power that fed electricity to potentially lethal high-voltage lines strung across the dam, and to shut down the boilers that might explode if their water supply were cut off. As the windowless mill went dark, workers left their posts and dashed outside. Many headed for the Pokegama Avenue Bridge, where they could view the dam. The full extent of the catastrophe became apparent as employees of the Blandon Paper Company and a few Grand Rapids passers-by watched in horror. With a growing and lasting roar, the water of the Mississippi completely undermined the central section of the dam. Water burst through, carrying great chunks of concrete and splintered broken segments of the dam. Thousands of cords of wood stored in the reservoir began to move, and then with tremendous velocity, they came tumbling and pouring through the gap in the dam. A log drive such as had never been seen even in the heyday of the logging industry was created by the logs sweeping past Grand Rapids like so many matchsticks. Observers on the bridge fled as the structure reverberated from crashing blows to the supports. There was only disbelief on the faces of the observers as the river powerhouse containing the water wheels and the generator was destroyed. The grinding room, which extended over the dam, contained three of the large new four-pocket grinders, those driven directly by the water-powered hydraulic system. They were big, heavy, solid, and secure-looking pieces of equipment. After all, they were the bedrock of the paper-making process, the place where the trees were ground to produce the pulp that was turned into the paper. It just didn't seem possible as the observers continuing to look disbelieving as the building disintegrated and those striking machines went plunging into the surging water and disappeared from sight. Disaster indeed. With great presence of mind, the yard foreman took one look at the expensive pulpwood hurtling downstream and hurriedly assembled a crew and vehicles. They dashed to a point miles downstream to swing booms across the channel to stop and hold the logs. The new superintendent, Miles Reif, called the dam tender at Pokegama Falls at the upriver end of the rapids. The urgent call prompted another to the Army Corps of Engineers office in St. Paul. The order came to close all gates of the Pokegama Dam. The river's natural flow was halted, leaving the reservoir to drain more quickly. In Grand Rapids, the village crew and several firemen gathered to address problems caused by the breaking of a water main that crossed the river bottom to supply the hospital in the southern part of the city. A jury system was promptly rigged to connect hydrants on both sides of the river. A reporter from the Duluth News Tribune contacted C.K. Andrews, who could not even begin to estimate the amount of damage. Ominously, he said, the plant will be closed indefinitely. As evening approached and the raging waters subsided and the reservoir emptied, a few enterprising fishermen headed for once deeper spots in well-known waters. Fish trapped when the river receded appeared on many a dinner table during subsequent days. But such small triumphs were not the rule, as Black Friday, as Blandon dubbed it, came to an end. At daybreak on Saturday, employees and townspeople viewed the scene with amazement. The Mississippi was but a thin, narrow stream flowing along the original riverbed, not seen for 46 years. But it was not a picture of a liberated Mississippi triumphantly rushing over boulders and stones, creating white water amidst lush trees and a beautiful shoreline. There was only desolation in all directions. Soft, thick, black mud was strewn with waterlogged pulpwood. Unsightly debris lay everywhere. The broken, jagged wreck of the dam and grinder room added to the grim scene. On Sunday, hoping to find at least some small financial remuneration from the disaster, Blandon, who had arrived from St. Paul, and Shacker drove upstream to assess the amount of water-saturated wood strewn about. Many thousands of logs lay exposed. Most were in sight of the mill dam, and salvage operations were concentrated there. At the same time, a mill crew began the arduous task of recovering the pulpwood that had swept downstream, some scattered along the riverbanks and some halted by log booms. On Blandon's orders on Monday, work immediately started on the construction of a cofferdam to establish a head of water so the mill could resume operation, and it would also hold back the river water while the permanent dam was replaced. About 100 feet behind the mill dam, a double wall of large timbers was erected and filled with great quantities of rock, gravel, cinder, and even bales of hay. Some mill workers joined the construction crews laboring on the project, and others served as watchmen or tended to temporary jobs. Thus, despite the extent of the calamity, all who wanted to work did so, remaining on the payroll. One employee commented in the company publication, The Broke Pile, "It sure was a surprise on just what sort of workmen we have at the mill Why, the boys were cat skinners, crane operators, drillers, and shovel runners. The writer further recorded a few of the remarks made when the boys were taking the part of a horse, such as wheeling cement, throwing sandbags, hauling timber, etc. Reflecting hectic days, the comments included, "My lord, isn't there any end to that cement? And who knows the weight of a sandbag? I want to get my right tonnage." Another, muttered by a worker driving a truck for the first time, was, "Whoa, giddy up, back up." And still another, "You guys can have your beer. Get me a large can of 3-in-1 oil. I squeak in every joint." August had been dry, but the skies turned gray in September. Fortunately, the clouds dropped less than a half inch of rain between September 5th and 10th. Despite rising water levels in Pokegama Lake and upstream, the once despised government dam remained closed for the purposes of the company, thus allowing unimpeded work on the cofferdam. By September 11th, the temporary dam was well underway, and token flowage was released at the Pokegama Dam. Only on September 15th did a nervous dam tender, wondering whether so Herculean a task as building a structure to restrain the vast waters could really have been accomplished in so short a time. And he opened the gates of the new dam to allow flowage of about 2,000 cubic feet per second. And next time, let's see how well that cofferdam is going to hold up and what happens next.